algorithms. So this is like an example of something you can really do dramatically faster with a quantum computer than with a classical one. So today we're going to see another quantum algorithm. This will be the last quantum algorithm that we really see. There are many, many other quantum algorithms that are known, and there's lots of interesting stuff, but you know, we have limited time, so we have to kind of focus on some of the highlights. So today we're going to see an algorithm where the speed up that you get is less dramatic, but the problem is somehow even more basic than factoring. I mean, factoring is a very basic number theoretic kind of problem, but the thing that we're going to see today is really extremely general and can be applied all over the place. On the other hand, the amount of speed up that you get is less. So, you know, there's some kind of a trade-off. And part of what goes into this trade-off has to do with sort of how structured the problem is, right? So factoring is like a very specific problem where there's all this algebraic structure that you can kind of get a handle on, and that's the reason that you can have an exponential speed up. And there are some fairly general things that are known that say that you know, if you have a problem that's not very structured, then actually you can't hope to have an exponential improvement. So that's kind of the reason that in the algorithm that we see today, that the improvement will be less. So the problem that we're going to look at is this problem of unstructured search, which is the following. So we're going to be given a black box. So this again will be a query problem, but you could think about, you know, non-query applications of it. But so in this problem, we're going to be given a black box for a string x in, you know, 0, 1 to the n. And here, well, so it's a string of n bits. And again, we're not given those bits explicitly. We're just given the ability to query a black box that will tell us, you know, is the ith bit of the string 1 or not? Is it 0 or 1? So given a black box for the string, we just wanted to determine, is there any one in the string? Right? So is there any I, so any index from 1 through n, such that xi is equal to 1? Or in other words, is the string the all-zero string, or is it some string that's not the all-zero string? Right? So this is like, you know, unstructured search. You should think about all of the possible indices from 1 through n that you might query as like items that you might be searching through, and you want to know, is there any item that's a marked item, right? So we would call the item marked if xi is equal to 1 and unmarked if xi is equal to 0, and we want to know, is there a marked item? So, you know, you can think about this as kind of like a sort of a black box model for an NP problem, right? If the only relevant thing about some problem, kind of the only thing that you can do is, you know, given a candidate solution, check whether it really is a solution. That's sort of like evaluating one of the bits of this string to tell whether xi is equal to 1. And then, you know, looking for an I such that xi is equal to 1 is like asking, is there a valid solution to some, you know, is there, you know, so for example, in like satisfiability, you have a Boolean formula, and you want to know, is there a way of assigning the bits such that the formula evaluates to true? And you could imagine that you could think about these bits x sub I as you know, telling you whether the formula evaluates to true or false on some, you know, where I is indexing the possible assignments of the bits to the formula. And so, you know, if really all you can do is just for arbitrary assignments of the bits figure out whether the formula is satisfied or not, then the problem you're trying to solve is this unstructured search problem. Okay, so now in, you know, satisfiability, maybe there's a bit more structure to what's going on, so you don't necessarily have to treat it according to this black box description. But what we're going to consider here is really where you just have the black box description. So you can think of it as some kind of black box model of NP, but it's you know, it's a black box problem. So it's in some sense maybe throwing away some structure you might have in an explicit computational problem. Okay, so let's just consider this problem. We're given this black box. We want to know, is there an I such that xi is equal to 1? All right. So the you know, classical complexity of this thing, I guess, should be pretty easy to see. So how many classical queries are we going to need to decide whether there's some I such that xi is equal to 1? Any thoughts? Upper bounds, lower bounds? OK, well, you definitely need to make at least one query, because, you know, you have to learn something. So one is definitely a lower bound, and n is definitely an upper bound, because if I make n queries, you know, then I know the whole string. Okay, so good. So I have some upper and lower bounds, but I'd like to do a bit better than that, right? So maybe you could improve the lower bound. Like, is one query going to be enough? Maybe I query, you know, I query in some random place and I see, oh, it's a zero. What do I know? Not a lot. So I probably need to query again. So how many queries am I going to have to make before I can be convinced that it's the all zero string? Or it's probably the all zero string.
Square root n.
We're talking about classical algorithms. So I mean, if I query it in square, suppose I query it in square root of n places, I could just choose them at random, or I could maybe I could have some, you know, clever strategy for which bits I'm going to query. If I query it in square root of n places, there's still n minus square root of n places I haven't queried. If I see a zero every time I query it on this square root of n places, then you know, I still sort of don't know anything about the value on the other places. So I'm actually going to have to make a number of queries that's linear in n before I can even get the right answer with bounded error. In fact, if I just want to always be right, if I want a deterministic algorithm, I really have to query all n places. Like literally n is the query complexity. And if I want to be correct with some constant probability, then maybe it suffices to randomly sample some constant fraction of the bits. But you know, it's still going to be some constant times n that I need. Right? So the classical query complexity is, regardless of whether we're talking about deterministic or randomized, it's just theta of n. So I just need to query everything. Okay, so that's the classical query complexity. Now, you know, I said that this is kind of a black box. You can think of this as a black box model of NP, and here we can show that in this kind of black box abstraction, actually you need to make a maximal number of queries to solve the problem. But of course, that doesn't really say anything about P versus NP, because this is some, you know, black box model of the problem. It's not the problem, right? So, you know, this is something which is true, and it kind of says that if you don't take account of any structure in an NP problem other than the ability to check whether a solution is in fact a candidate solution is in fact a solution, then you would need a maximal number of queries. But you know, there could be some additional structure in real NP problems. Okay. So, but anyway, as far as this query problem is concerned, the query complexity classically is maximal. And what it turns out is that, you know, quantumly you can do better. So with a quantum algorithm, you can get by with dramatically fewer queries. You can get by with about square root of n queries. So that's where the square root of n answer came from. So quantumly we can do better, and the algorithm that allows you to do better is called Grover's algorithm. And so that's what we're going to see now. Okay. So how is this algorithm going to work? So first of all, to make things simple, let's think about the case where we have a unique marked item. There's only one index I such that x of I is equal to 1. Intuitively, that should be the hardest case, because you know, this is like, you know, this, you can think of this problem as sort of like looking for a needle in a haystack, right? You've got a haystack with n things in it, and intuitively it should be harder to find the needle if there's only one needle, right? If the haystack is half needles, then it's a lot easier. Also maybe a lot more painful if you fall into it. But if there's only one needle, then you know, that's sort of like, that sounds like it should be the hardest case. So let's consider the hardest case. We'll solve the hardest case, and then we can say something later on about you know, what we could do to handle the case where maybe instead of there being one marked item, there were two marked items, which would still be a pretty hard case. But it's, you know, if you know how to handle the one marked item case, you can kind of handle the general case pretty easily. Okay, so let's assume one marked item. So let's say x sub w is equal to 1, x sub I is equal to 0 for I not equal to w. And what we're going to do when we query the oracle is we're going to use this phase kickback idea. So we saw that by you know, using the normal kind of reversible oracle that computes the value, in this case x sub I, into a register, by, you know, putting in the superposition for that register, and so you put this minus state in that register, then what happens is basically you compute the information about this bit that you want to query into the phase instead of into a register. So let's just imagine that we do that, and we're just going to take our black box to be the phase flip back black box. So we're going to use phase kickback. So what that says is that I is going to get mapped to -1 to the x of i times I. Right. So if we're querying some index I, this is the action of the query. We get a phase of -1 if it's a marked item, and we get no phase if it's an unmarked item. Okay. And so now if we put together these two things, that we're assuming that there's a unique marked item, and that we're going to use this query that does phase kickback, then we can write down a unitary transformation that represents this black box. So I'm going to call it use of x, because it's the unitary that encodes the black box string x. And this is just going to be the identity minus twice the projection onto the marked item. Why is that? Because, well, for anything which is a basis state which is not the marked item, this thing will just act as the identity. It'll put in this phase of +1. And on the other hand, if you have the marked item, then you have 1 minus 2, which is -1, times the marked item. Right? So this thing is going to, this is the matrix which is going to have the behavior of this query. Okay. All right. So that's our query that we can perform. And now we want to somehow describe an algorithm that's going to make queries and do some other non-query operations, and is going to produce it's going to find out what the marked item is. The way I described this problem originally, we just want to decide whether there is any marked item. But what we're doing now is assuming that there's one marked item, and we're going to find what it is. Okay? And if we can do that, of course, we can distinguish the case where there's one marked item from the case where there's no marked item, because you can always then go in and check whether the item that you found really was marked. And so if you can find a unique marked item, you can also distinguish between 0 versus 1 marked items. Okay, so now we would like to come up with some initial state for our algorithm, and then some sequence of transformations that, some of which are the black box, some of which are just some other unitaries that don't depend on what item is marked, and then we would like that to somehow produce a state which reveals information about the marked item. So what initial state should we take? Well, I mean, all of the quantum algorithms that we've seen so far basically started from like a uniform superposition over all of the possibilities. There's not really any reason to take any other state, so let's do that one. Okay, so our initial state is going to be just a uniform superposition over all of the possible marked items. And actually, we won't have any ancillary space. We're just going to have a space which is only big enough to store an index into this string. Okay, so we're going to have a state I'm going to call psi, which is 1 over the square root of n, the sum I equals 1 to n, I. That's our initial state. And now what we would like to do is some sequence of operations that is going to somehow take the state to w. And what we're going to do is we're going to alternate applications of the black box. So the first thing we'll do is we'll query with the black box on this state. Then we have to do some other transformation that's going to do something non-trivial, right? If we just keep applying queries over and over without doing anything in between, then really nothing interesting will happen, because this ux squared is the identity, right? So there's, if you do this thing twice, it's like doing nothing at all. So we have to do something in between. We have to come up with some operation. And something that's a reasonable thing to do is just a reflection about this initial state. I mean, we don't really have anything to go on initially. We don't really know what item is marked. So an operation you can do that kind of respects that symmetry, that we should do something which treats all of the items the same way, is just to reflect about this initial state, which is itself a uniform superposition over all the possible marked items. So that's what we're going to do. We're going to define an operation v, which is going to be a reflection about the initial state. So that's kind of like this. I'm going to write it as 2 times the projector onto psi minus the identity. So here I have some relative minus sign between the operation I've written here and the operation I've written here. This is like a reflection about psi. This, I guess, you should think of as a reflection about the orthogonal complement of w. because there's an overall minus sign. An overall minus sign is not going to matter, really, because that's just going to be some global phase, you know, for our quantum state. So that's not going to be anything observable. But just the calculations that we want to do will work out a little bit nicer if I have, you know, this particular operation here and this particular operation here. Just makes things a little bit better. But these, you know, these operations are kind of, you can think about them as the same kind of operation. But, you know, here what you're doing is basically reflecting about the marked item, and here you're reflecting about the uniform superposition. Okay. All right. Yes. Yeah, so we're not explicitly working with qubits. We just have some n-dimensional space. So these are the indices into the string. You know, it could be that n is a power of 2 and you write these indices down using qubits, but we're not going to make use of any of the structure of the, you know, how you might choose to represent these indices.
Okay, so like I equals 5 is just some arbitrary.
Yeah. We just have an n-dimensional state space and we just label the states, you know, 1 through n. Okay. We could represent them using bits if we like, but it's not going to change any of the stuff that we're going to do. You could ask, I mean, so we're going to focus on just what's the query complexity, you know, how many queries you have to make to get the answer out. But you could ask, you know, how hard is it to do this reflection about the uniform superposition, right? I mean, that's, because if you actually wanted to run this algorithm, you might care about the complexity of doing that in addition to the number of total steps that you needed. But that's a pretty easy operation because, you know, suppose you do represent things using bits, right? Suppose n happens to be a power of 2, and you represent the indices using qubits, then what you want to do is reflect about the uniform superposition. So that's a basis state if you go into the Hadamard basis, right? So you just apply a Hadamard transform to go into that basis, then you only put in a minus sign for the all zero state, and then you go back into the kind of undo your Hadamard transform. So that's an operation which is, this is an operation that's very easy to do. You can just do it using a small number of gates acting on qubits if you have some reasonable representation. But we're not gonna do things explicitly. Other questions? Okay. So these are the two operations we're going to do, ux and v, and the whole algorithm will be literally just we do ux and then v and then ux and then v and ux and v. We just go back and forth, and we would like to get the state to be something that has good information in it about the marked item. Okay, so we're going to repeat this kind of basic block. This is sometimes called the Grover iteration. V times ux, we're going to do this k times. And we're going to have to figure out how to, how to choose k in order for this to do something good. But then what we're going to do is measure and hope that the result is w. And if we can choose k such that there's a good probability that the result is W when we make this measurement, then that's a good algorithm. And that's an algorithm that makes K queries. Right? So what we want to see is that by taking K to be like big O of root N, we can make it so that when we measure, it will be the case that when we measure, we're likely to get the outcome W. And then we'll say that there's a root N or a big O of root N query algorithm for finding the marked item, for solving this unstructured search problem. But now what we need to do is we need to understand what happens when we do this, right? So what does the how does the quantum state evolve when we apply this algorithm, and how should we pick k so that things will work out well? Okay. So it turns out that this is a very easy calculation to do. I mean, it's a lot simpler than some of the kind of stuff we had to understand to analyze Shor's algorithm, because in particular, you can see that the evolution will stay within a two-dimensional subspace, right? So we're working in an n-dimensional Hilbert space, but we have only two states that are really relevant, right? We're starting in the state psi, and then we're doing reflections about W and psi, right? So all of the action will take place in a two-dimensional subspace that's spanned by W and psi, right? So, I mean, W and psi are not orthogonal states, but they span some two-dimensional subspace, and that's where all of the action will occur, right? So we want to compute, the thing we're trying to compute is like the state V ux to the k acting on psi, and so we can work in a two-dimensional subspace, which is the subspace spanned by w and psi. And so now what we would like to do is, you know, just understand how this operation acts just within that two-dimensional invariant subspace, and that will allow us to understand the behavior of the algorithm. Okay, so to do that, it's enough to just think about how these matrices, U, X, and V, I mean, actually, each of them, this two-dimensional subspace is an invariant subspace separately for both U, X, and V. So we can just look at how these two operators act on the two states in this basis. And that will allow us to understand what's going on. Okay, so if we have UX acting on psi, well, that's the state that we're going to have after the first operation in the algorithm, right? After we, you know, after we apply the first gate, after we apply the query to the initial state, then what we have is this. And that's pretty easy to calculate. So this is the identity minus twice the projection onto W acting on psi. So the first term is just going to give us psi. And then we have minus twice, well, the inner product between W and psi times W. And what's the inner product between W and psi? 1 over root n, right? This is 1 over root n. So this is just psi minus 2 over root n W. Good. And then we also will have to apply V on psi. So, you know, if we want to apply V to this, we can do that if we can understand what's V acting on psi and what's V acting on W. So the easy thing to figure out is what's V acting on psi. That's just psi, right? Because psi is just, you know, eigenstate of V with eigenvalue 1. And so then we also need to know what happens when you act with V on this term in the superposition, when you act with V on W. And what is that? Well, it's a similar calculation to this, right? So that's 2 times the projector onto psi minus the identity acting on W. So that's just 2 over root n psi minus W, right? And then we also have to act with U on W. So UX on W is just minus W, right? Because UX is something that reflects about, you know, I guess the orthogonal complement of the, you know, this 1D subspace spanned by W. So this is just going to give us minus W. Okay. So now I have everything that I need to work out what's going to happen in this two-dimensional subspace. All right, but now it'll be easier to understand what's going on, actually, if we work in an orthonormal basis, right? So the states psi and W are, you know, they span a 2D subspace, but they're not orthogonal to each other. Actually, I mean, it's pretty important that they're not orthogonal to each other. If they were orthogonal to each other, then we would be not really doing anything when we reflected about these two different directions. It's because they have some slight non-orthogonality that that something interesting will actually happen when we do this. So there's this kind of, you know, 1 over root n that we get when we take the inner product between those two directions. So what we should do is we should work in some orthonormal basis. So what we can do is we can just use, you know, Gram-Schmidt to come up with an orthonormal basis for this two-dimensional space. So if we do Gram-Schmidt, what we can do is we can define some vector that I'm going to call W perp, which is going to be the vector in this two-dimensional subspace that's orthogonal to W, right? So how do I find that? Well, I take the vector other than W, so that's the vector psi, and then I subtract off the projection onto W. So that's then going to give me some vector that's orthogonal to W. So I subtract off an amount of W, which is equal to, you know, the inner product between W and psi. So I take this thing, and then if I want this to be a normalized state, I divide this by whatever the normalization is, which I'm not going to write down explicitly because we won't actually need it. Okay. So what is this vector? Well, I mean, I guess it's kind of clear what this vector has to be. It's like what I get if I take psi and I subtract off the W piece. So psi is just the uniform superposition over all the possible items. And so this is just going to be, you know, the sum I equals 1 to n minus, I equals 1 to n, but where I is not equal to W. And then there are n minus 1 such terms, so the normalizing factor must be 1 over root n minus 1. So that's explicitly what this state W perp is. This is the state in this two-dimensional subspace that's orthogonal to W. Okay. All right. So now what I can do, you know, I want to somehow write the action of these operators in this two-dimensional subspace, but now in terms of the basis of W and W perp. And in order to do that, I need to know what psi is. I need to express psi in terms of W and W perp, right? Because you know, psi is some vector in this two-dimensional subspace, and if I re-express psi in terms of that basis, then I can use all these expressions to come up with 2x2 matrices that give me the action of these operators on this 2D subspace. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to write psi as you know, some linear combination of W and W perp, and I guess it's clear what that linear combination has to be. I mean, you can take all this stuff and like kind of like very formally rewrite things in terms of W and W perp, but I guess it has to be that, first of all, the amount of W that you have is 1 over root n, right? Because that's what the coefficient is in front of W in the state psi, because it has an amplitude 1 over root n for all of the basis states. So it's this plus some amount of psi perp, and the amount of psi perp is going to be root 1 minus 1 over n. So this is just the factor that you get in order for this state to be normalized, because W is a normalized state. If I take these two things and I square them and sum them up, I have to get 1, right? So this must be the correct amplitude for W perp. And now what I'm going to do is I'm going to write this in a particular way. I'm going to define an angle theta, and I'm just going to say that I can write this as sine theta times W plus cosine theta times W perp. Certainly I can do that, because this is some real linear combination of these two states, and so I'm just going to define sine theta to be 1 over root n, right? And then this is, you know, this is another way of writing what psi is. And I'm actually going to write everything in terms of this angle theta, because you'll see that things will behave nicely if I do things in terms of theta. Okay, so sine theta is 1 over root n. All right, good. So now if I want to know how the algorithm behaves, I should take ux and b, and I should write them in the basis of w and w perp. So in the w perp basis, what do I have? Well, the easy one to write down is ux, right? So ux is equal to the identity minus twice the projection onto w. So in the WW perp basis, this is just the matrix that looks like this, minus 1, 0, 0, 1. Right? That's the 2x2 matrix. Yes?
What is the angle theta, the angle between?
Well, we'll draw a picture later on. I mean, it's going to be, you know, so W and psi, theta is a small angle, right? Because sine theta is 1 over root n. You should think of n as big, because we want to solve a large problem. So theta is something which is small. W and psi are vectors that are almost orthogonal, but not quite. So this is like the angle away from 90 degrees. In other words, you know, this is the angle between psi and W perp. Yeah. I mean, because, you know, the cosine of the angle is what you get when you take the angle. Okay. And we'll draw a geometric picture later, and we'll see like what, you know, how you can sort of interpret what's going on in terms of a rotation in some two-dimensional space. But we'll come back to that. Okay, so this is ux, and then we should also write down what v is. So v is twice the projection onto psi minus the identity. And so what we should do is we should write down the projection onto psi in terms of in terms of this notation, right? So what this is it's like sine theta, cosine theta, sine theta, cosine theta. Right? So we have this thing minus the identity. So what is this? This is going to be 2 sine squared theta minus 1. And here we're going to have 2 sine theta cosine theta, and then it's going to be symmetric, so 2 sine theta cosine theta, and then over here we have 2 cosine squared theta minus 1. So that's the matrix V, and now you pull out your trig identities, And maybe you remember better than me, so, but 2 sine theta, cosine theta, this is the one I can always remember. This is sine 2 theta. Sine 2 theta. Over here we have sine 2 theta. And one of these is cosine 2 theta, and the other one is minus cosine 2 theta. Unfortunately, I have it written down that this one is minus cosine 2 theta, and this one is cosine 2 theta. So this is the matrix. This is a matrix that describes, well, it better describe a reflection, right? Because V is a reflection in some, I mean, it's a reflection in some n-dimensional space, but there's some two-dimensional invariant subspace where all of the action takes place, and it's also a reflection in that two-dimensional subspace. So this is just the matrix of some reflection in this two-dimensional space. All right, good. So now, you know, I'm really just set up to kind of turn the crank and see what's going to happen. I want to understand the operator V times UX, because that's the thing that I'm going to be repeatedly applying to psi. So let's do that. So V times UX is equal to the product of these two matrices, so minus cosine 2 theta, sine 2 theta, sine 2 theta, cosine 2 theta, times u, and u is minus 1, 0, 0, 1. So that's pretty easy. So this is cosine 2 theta, sine 2 theta, minus sine 2 theta, and cosine 2 theta. Right. So what is that? It's a rotation, right? So you know, this is what I get if I take the product of two reflections. I'm going to get a rotation, right? And I mean, this is a general statement about you know, transformations in a two-dimensional space. But here, you can quite explicitly see this is going to be a rotation by an angle 2 theta. So this is a rotation by 2 theta. Okay, good. So now what we should do is we should understand what happens when we apply this k times. Right, so we want to apply v times u to the x to the power k. So what we see is that v times u sub x to the power k is, well, maybe you can tell me what it should be. I mean, I want to take that matrix and I want to apply the kth power. Exactly, right. So if I rotate by an angle 2 theta, then if I do that k times, I'm rotating by an angle 2k theta. So that's just exactly the same matrix where I replace 2 theta by 2k theta. Right, good. So cosine 2k theta, sine 2k theta, minus sine 2k theta, cosine 2k theta. I mean, there's some way of showing that this is the matrix that you get by, like, you know, multiplying this thing by itself and applying trigonometric identities, and you could, like, use induction to prove that, you know, this is what you get. But that's kind of silly because we have this geometric intuition for what's going on, and we know that this is a rotation by 2 theta. So if we do that k times, we get a rotation by 2k theta. So there's just kind of no point in doing that calculation. All right, good. So this is the action of the algorithm on the initial state. So that what we see then is that within this two-dimensional subspace, this thing acting on psi is what? Well, it's this matrix, cosine 2k theta, sine 2k theta, minus sine 2k theta, cosine 2k theta, acting on the initial vector psi. And what is psi? Well, psi is the vector with components sine theta, cosine theta. So here we have sine theta, theta. So, you know, again, you could sort of just, like, very explicitly, you know, multiply this thing out and then use some trigonometric identities to simplify. But, you know, if you, again, use your geometric intuition, it's going to save you from doing a bit of work. This is a vector that's already rotated away by theta, and then we're going to rotate it again by 2k theta. And so the overall thing is going to be something that's been rotated by 2k plus 1 theta. Right? So this is just going to be the sine of 2k plus 1 theta and the cosine of 2k plus 1 theta. If you don't believe me, multiply it out and, you know, use some trig identities. Okay, so this is our final state, and now what we would like to do is we would like to measure. So when we measure, we want to compute the probability that we'll get the W state. And W just is one of the vectors in our basis, right? So when we measure, the probability that we see W is just the square of the associated with amplitude, associated amplitude, right? So the probability that we see W is just sine squared 2k plus 1 theta. Good. So now what we should do is we should try to make this large, right? We want it to be that when we measure, we're likely to see the marked item. W is the marked item. So we want to make this big. And to do that, what we basically want to do is we want to set this argument to be equal to, or you know, close to would be good enough. We would like the argument of the sine to be close to pi over 2. Right. So to make this big, we're going to choose k so that so that 2k plus 1 theta is close to pi over 2, right? Because sine pi over 2 is 1. So what that says is that k should be about pi over 4. K should be about pi over 4 theta. So I mean, I'm interested in the case where theta is small now, right? So sine theta is 1 over root n, but in the limit where n is large, you know, theta is going to be small. So basically, theta is going to be like 1 over root n. So this is going to be about pi over 4 times root n. Right? So this is the square root of n in the complexity, right? So we see that if we take a number of iterations of this process, which goes like square root of n, and we even computed some explicit constant here, pi over 4, if we take this number of steps, then the probability will be close to 1. Now, it won't be exactly equal to 1 because, you know, well, first of all, we made some approximation that, you know, sine theta was close to 1 over root n, so this was approximate anyway. And, you know, in writing here that, you know, k was approximately pi over 4 theta, you know, I basically kind of neglected this 1 because that's not going to matter because, you know, k is going to be big, so that's going to be something negligible anyway. So, you know, I made some approximations when I did this. But even if you computed, you know, what was the exact k that would make this thing equal to 1, the k that you would get would, in general, not be an integer, right? But k has to be an integer. It's the number of times you apply some unitary transformation. So it won't be possible to rotate things so that you go exactly to w, but you can go as close as you like. And if n is large, you know, you can actually get, like, within 1 over n or something like that with some, you know, with kind of like the best possible choice. So, you know, we're only going to succeed with a probability which is, you know, 1 minus something that gets small as n gets large. But that's very good. I mean, we only demand, like, maybe 2/3 success probability. We can definitely get that with a number of steps that goes like square root of n. So what we see is that they go square root of n queries. And, you know, if we accounted for the cost of doing the other operations, actually, that would not introduce much overhead. So in fact, big O of square root of n running time also would allow us to find W. Okay. So maybe now I should give this geometric picture that kind of will help to explain what's going on. I mean, here I did the algebra, but there's also, I mean, I guess you can kind of see from the way that I explain things, there should be some nice geometric picture of what's going on. So let me draw this two-dimensional subspace. So this is going to be the vector W, and this is going to be the vector W perp. And then where does the vector psi sit in this picture? Well, psi is sine theta W plus cos theta W perp, and theta is small. So that's a vector which is close to W perp, but it's away from it by an angle theta. So it looks like this. This is psi, and this angle is so psi is, you know, almost but not quite orthogonal to W. And now what do we do? So the first thing that we do is we perform a reflection about, you know, really about the orthogonal complement of W, because we're sending the W piece of the state to minus, you know, we're putting a minus sign in front of the W piece of the state. So what that says is that this vector psi actually is going to be reflected about W perp. So it's going to be sent to, you know, this vector, right, where this angle is theta. Right? So this is the vector that I get by applying u sub x on psi. Right? And then the next thing that I do is I take that vector and I reflect it about psi, right? Because the next thing I do is I apply v, and v is something that keeps that keeps psi unchanged, but it sends anything orthogonal to psi to minus that. So that's a reflection about psi. And so that vector is going to get reflected about psi. Now that vector is an angle 2 theta away from psi. So that's going to get set to a vector on the other side, like this, where this angle is 2 theta. Right? So this is v times ux times psi. Right? So this is how you kind of see that if I do both of these things, I do ux and then I do v, that what I've done effectively is to rotate the vector by an angle 2 theta. Right? It's being rotated, in the clockwise direction here. I mean, that's kind of, I guess, because you've got the minus sign here instead of here. So it's being rotated from w perp towards w, and it's been rotated by an angle 2 theta. And since it started an angle theta away from w perp, it's actually gone to 3 theta away. Right? That's our 2k plus 1. K is equal to 1. So it's been rotated over to this position. And now if you iterate this again and again, it's just being rotated by 2 theta each time, right? So if I have here vux squared psi, that's going to be over here. This is another 2 theta of rotation, right? And so it's just rotating. It's just marching along. And you want to pick the k to be, the smallest thing such that this vector is, pretty close to w. So as I was saying, in general, you won't hit it exactly because it won't be some integer number of 2 theta rotations that take you to the w, but you just take, the closest that you can get. And the number of iterations that you have to apply, because this rotation angle theta is like 1 over root n, the number of times you have to do this goes like root n. And you really get quite close because, you're rotating by a very small angle each time. So if you choose the closest thing, you get really quite close to w. Something that you can see, by the way, is it's really important that you stop at the right time, right? Because you're rotating, you're getting closer and closer and closer. But quantum mechanics is unitary, so you can't somehow have a process that just involves unitary evolution and is going to make you converge to w, right? Something unitary has to keep happening. And so if you you get to w, but then you keep applying this iteration, you're going to go away from it, right? You're just going to be rotating in this two-dimensional space. So if you keep going, you're actually going to make things worse. You really want to stop at the right time. Okay. Questions about this? Yes. Well, I mean, if you want it, there is some transformation in this state space that would just take you there, but you have to know what w is in order to do that. So these are just sort of like, the operations that we have available to us, right? We have u sub x, that's the query, and then we can do something else that doesn't depend on the input. Now, you could say, well, maybe we should replace v by something else that would give us a bigger rotation. But there is nothing else. I mean, v is the thing which is going to give us the biggest rotation possible. So if we change v to any other operation that doesn't depend on what w is, then we won't be able to have a bigger rotation. Obviously, if we did an operation that depended on w, that like somehow knew what the marked item was, we could just rotate there. But that would be cheating because that's what we're trying to find. So.
And so in advance what k is, and then you apply this.
That's right. So we assumed. We know what k is because we assume that there's one marked item, and this value of k that we got didn't depend on which item was marked, but it did depend actually on the fact that there was only one marked item. So something else you could ask would be, what would happen if there's more marked items? And you could do the same kind of calculation, and what you would find is that basically you would just rotate faster. So this is like you would intuitively expect that if there are more needles in the haystack, they should be easier to find. And the way that that's reflected, if you do this this kind of analogous process in the case where you have more marked items is just that you rotate faster. So if you're rotating faster, you'll get there sooner. And if you know what the number of marked items is, then you can stop at whatever that earlier time is, and you can find the marked item. I think there was a question first.
Oh, I was going to ask what you do if you don't know how many marked items
there are. Right. Okay. So that's a good question. So if you don't know how many marked items there are, you have to do something. Just kind of figure it out. Well, so there's one strategy. There are strategies which are based on sort of like guessing how many items there might be and sort of trying increasing sequences of how many marked items there might be and stopping after the right number of times for that. There's kind of a more interesting strategy, though, that uses this phase estimation thing that we saw before. So, you know, what happens if you have some number of marked items is that you rotate in this two-dimensional subspace at some rate that depends on the number of marked items. And what that corresponds to is that, this operator, v times ux, will have different eigenvalues. So something that you can do is you can do phase estimation on this operator to learn something about the eigenvalues of it. And those eigenvalues will tell you what the number of marked items is. So you can actually learn the number of marked items. This is sometimes called quantum counting. You can count the number of marked items, at least approximately, from applying phase estimation to this operator. And then once you know that, then you know when to stop. So you can count the number of marked items, and that sort of tells you how far you want to rotate. I think there were some other questions, too. Yeah,
you're saying that if there are more marked items, you're going to rotate quicker.
That's right.
But doesn't that mean your estimate's going to be farther off? Because if you're rotating by a bigger anvil each time, then you're going to, in general, miss W by more.
That's right. That's true. So you have to sort of like work out what the effect of that is. But you know, the worst case, you know, where you like rotate by some really big amount, is that you know, instead of having an overlap that goes like 1 - 1 over n with W, you'll have just some constant overlap. But that still gives you a constant probability of finding W. So you're really only in a better situation if you're rotating faster. I mean, it may seem like something is getting worse, but overall, it's really making things a lot better. Yeah. Yes.
So if you had more than one marked item. So I guess you mean just in the black box would perform the unitary that's I minus 2 W plus minus 2 whatever else.
Exactly. Okay.
So you'd then be rotating towards just a uniform superposition of all the marked items?
That's right.
Okay. So you'd find one of them with some even probability.
That's right. So if there's a very large number of marked items, you know, it might not be reasonable to ask that you find all of them. Well, you could work out what the cost of doing that would be, but it would be more than just the cost of figuring out whether some item is marked or finding one marked item. The simplest thing to think about would just be like, how hard is it to find one of the marked items? And you could do that by making the uniform superposition that you described and then measuring it.
Okay. So for that, though, do we need to know? We don't need to know how many there are, right?
Well, you need to know because you need to know when to stop.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. But if you don't know that a priori, you can find out with this quantum counting idea.
Okay. And so that's because we found K somehow through the inner product of this state we're rotating towards?
Well, you can find K from the eigenvalues of this operator. So you can work out what the eigenvalues of this thing are. They'll be related to what angle it's a rotation by. Mm-hmm. And if it's a rotation by a bigger angle, that'll be reflected in the eigenvalues. Mm-hmm. And there's details you have to work out to understand how good an approximation of K you could get by doing phase estimation to a certain precision. So those are details you would have.
And once you've rotated to close to W, what's the measurement that you make?
Right, so something you would do is you would measure just in the computational basis to figure out which item you're in. And if you're in this unique marked item case, then what you would get would be, probably you would get W if you're close to W. If you're a little bit away from it, you might get some other item. It might tell you the index of some item that's actually not marked. But then you just go and make one more query and figure out, is that item that I got really a marked item? And if it's an unmarked item, then you know that you were just kind of unlucky and you were off. Project it onto the wrong state, but more than likely you'll actually get W.
And if you've got more than half of the items are marked, are you better off doing the inverse looking for?
Yeah, I think that's right. There's actually something funny about this. I mean, there's something that I've kind of swept under the rug a little bit in general when we talk about query complexity, which is that when we look at this phase oracle. It just puts a minus sign in front of the in the context of this thing, the marked things, and not in front of the unmarked things. But up to some global phase, that's exactly the same as putting a -1 in front of the unmarked things and not in front of the marked things. So actually, there's no way to distinguish those two possibilities if you're only using the phase oracle. So not only would it like do the same thing, but like you couldn't even distinguish the case where all but one of the items are marked from the case where one of the items is marked. Unless you're doing something that doesn't just make, phase oracle queries, so you don't have to just use the phase oracle. Like you can do this thing where you query one of the items and you figure out whether it's marked or not, and now you sort of know something about the global phase. But
so actually, what do you mean by query one of the items? We're assuming it's another operation you can do.
Well, something you can do is you can just make a classical query, right? I mean, you can do that using the black box that you're given. you know, how would you do that using this phase oracle? Well, you need to be able to really do a controlled phase oracle, and that's something that you can do using the way that we built this phase oracle from the original oracle.
So the setup you're imagining is we have this black box that performs that unitary, but also actually has this bit string sitting inside?
Yeah, I mean, what I really imagine is that really the black box that you have is the thing which will compute the value of x sub I into another register, adding things bitwise one, two. That's what you really have. And then from that, you can create this phase oracle yourself. But you actually have the ability to just make a query and learn what is one of the bits of I of x. So this shows us that we can solve this unstructured search problem in square root of n queries, and actually you can do things more generally, even if you have any number of marked items, with some details that we're not going to talk about. But the last thing that I would like to talk about, and maybe we won't actually get through the whole thing today because there's probably more details than we have time to do. But the next thing that I would like to show is that actually this algorithm is optimal. So you can prove a lower bound that says that this is really the best you can do. So there's no algorithm, no matter how you choose to query, which will do any better than square root of n. And this was actually proven even before the algorithm was discovered, like sort of a historical note. So it was actually known first that square root of n was really the best you could do, and then later, and I think independently, Grover showed that you actually could achieve this square root of n. So maybe what we'll do is just kind of the setup, and then next time we can actually see the proof. So, but this is one of the nice things about considering query algorithms. You know, in quantum query complexity, you can really prove lower bounds that show that something is the best you can do. So, you know, it's apparently really hard to prove that, you know, there's no efficient classical algorithm for factoring, because just, you know, the space of algorithms is huge. And similarly, for quantum algorithms, it's hard to prove lower bounds for explicit tasks like factoring. But if you just want to prove you need a lot of queries to solve some quantum query problem, that's something that we know how to do. So I want to show you how you do that for this problem. Okay, so it turns out that omega of square root of n queries are necessary. So let's look at what a general quantum query algorithm looks like, right? I mean, we want to somehow reason not just about this algorithm or some specific family of algorithms that includes this algorithm, but really a completely general thing that we might do. Okay, so what does an algorithm look like? Well, we're going to start with some initial state. I'm going to have a bunch of qubits. We're going to start with some initial state, which I guess without loss of generality could be, you know, the all zero state. And then we're going to apply some general unitary. So that would allow us to actually create a general input state. So I'm going to call this V0. And then we're going to do a query. And now, you know, our whole space might include some ancilla registers that, you know, are not part of the space that's being queried, because we could have some workspace where we're doing some computation on the side. We didn't in this algorithm, but more generally, we might do that. So we have to allow that. So then what we'll have here is a query, right? And so that's only going to act on some subset of the qubits. There might also be some ancillas that are not involved. And then after we do the query, now we can do another completely general operation. So these operations could, you know, they could involve these ancilla registers. And also, there's no reason for them to be the same, right? I mean, in the algorithm that we considered here, V0 was the same as V1. But there's no reason that has to be the case. So this could be a completely arbitrary unitary operation on a, you know, on an arbitrarily high dimensional space. Definitely, you know, the most general algorithm does not just live in a two-dimensional subspace. And then we make another query, and we just continue like this. So we're gonna, then we'll do another unitary, V2, and this continues. And then, you know, we make some final query. And then at the end of the day, we do. So let's say we've done capital T queries. Then we're gonna do some last unitary, V sub capital T. And then we're going to make some, so that's going to give us some final state, and we're going to make a measurement at the end of the day, and that's supposed to tell us the answer to the problem. So this is the most general algorithm, and now what I would like to do is, you know, analyze an algorithm of this kind, where these V sub I's could be completely arbitrary unitary matrices, and I don't assume anything about the dimension of the space that these things are acting on. And now I want to somehow argue that I really need to make a lot of queries, that you know, capital T has to be big in order for the output over here to tell me what the answer is. So I want to have a little bit of notation for understanding what's going on. So I'm going to call the state after the ith unitary operation that doesn't depend on the input, in other words, after v sub I, I'm going to call that state psi sub I. So this is going to be psi sub 0. And then over here, there's going to be psi sub 1. Here, there's going to be psi sub 2, et cetera. And I'm not going to have some notation for the state after I just apply the unitary that depends on the input after I apply the black box, because that's just not going to be something that I need. OK? And then all the way here at the end, I'm going to have some state psi sub capital T. OK. And I'm going to consider two different situations. I'm going to consider the case where there's no marked item and where there's one marked item. And I'm going to try to show that you would need a lot of queries to distinguish those cases. Right? So I mean, we know that this algorithm can distinguish those cases using order square root of n queries. And I really want to see that that's the best thing you can do. So we're going to consider this problem where you're trying to distinguish 0 from 1 marked items. That's a problem that's has really the same hardness as the problem that we considered already of deciding whether there's any marked item is only a harder problem. So what we're going to do is we're going to call, so these states, psi sub little t, these are going to be the states in the case where there's no marked items. So let's let psi sub t be the state just before the t plus first query. With no marked item. And then I could also consider the case where the marked item is I. Right? So there's some other possibility that instead of this thing being the identity, which is what would happen if I had no marked item, that this would be the thing that would indicate that the ith item is marked. So I'm going to call that, I'm going to call the state corresponding to that psi sub t superscript I. So that's, again, a state just before the t plus first query with marked item I, right? So with xi is equal to 1 and, x sub j is equal to 0 for j not equal to I. So this is for marked item I. So this is just some notation. So these are the states that I have in a general algorithm. And now I want to show, the kind of the argument is going to be to try to show that these states can't move apart from each other very fast, right? In order to distinguish the two possibilities, where there's no marked item or where I is the marked item, these states would have to, in some sense, get far away from each other, right? Because it would have to be that there's a measurement that you can perform that would distinguish these two cases. And if these quantum states are just close, there's not going to be any measurement you can do that will distinguish them. So if we can show that you need to make like square root of n queries to have these states be very different, that's going to be that's going to give us the kind of lower bound that we want. And what do we know? So suppose we want to distinguish the case where there's no marked item from the case where the marked item is I. Right? So to distinguish the case where there's no marked item from the case where the marked item is I, we would need these states to be far apart in the following sense. We must have, let's say just that the norm of the difference between the two states should be at least epsilon. And so psi sub t minus psi sub t superscript I, this should be at most epsilon, right? If we want things to work with constant probability, right? So it should be this for some positive epsilon. And what epsilon we demand will have to do with what probability we want to succeed. But if we want to succeed with constant probability, then epsilon will have to be a constant. And let's not sweat the details. Okay? All right. So if we just want to do this for one particular I, we'll need this. But if you just want to solve the problem of distinguishing no marked item from the marked item being I for one particular I, that's an easy problem. You just query the ith bit, right? That's not going to be a hard thing. But what we want is that this really should be the case for all I. Right, we want to solve the problem in the worst case. So we want it to be that no matter which item is marked, we can distinguish that from the case where there's no marked item. Right? So this should hold for all I. And what that means is that actually if we sum this quantity up over all I, then that has to be at least n times epsilon, right? So the sum over all I of psi t minus psi t I, so the norm of the difference of those two states, that had better be at least n times epsilon. Okay. All right. So we want to show that this quantity, you know, it's going to take a lot of queries for this quantity to get big. And notice that this quantity initially is 0, right? Because the initial state that we take for our algorithm, psi sub 0, is some state that just does not depend on I, right? So it doesn't depend on I, and in particular, it doesn't depend on, I mean, it doesn't depend on anything about the input, right? So if there's no marked item, or if the marked item is I, this state is exactly the same. So initially, we have, you know, psi sub 0 minus psi sub 0 superscript I. This is equal to 0. Right? So now what do we know? We have this quantity, and this is true for all I. I mean, so in particular, the sum over I of this thing is equal to 0. So we have this quantity that we're going to use as some kind of measure of progress of the algorithm. We're going to consider the sum over I of the difference between the state after t queries if there's no marked item or if the marked item is I. That's our measure of, you know, how much progress we've made. And that quantity is initially 0 because we have some state that doesn't depend on the oracle at all. And at the end of the day, it has to be big. It has to be, you know, this capital N is what I called lowercase n before. Sorry, this is just the number of possible items. So this thing has to be linear in n if we're to succeed, and it has to start at 0. So what we can do to show a lower bound is show that if we make one query and then do a completely arbitrary unitary operation after that, that does not allow us to increase this quantity that much. Right? So if we could show that this quantity could increase by an amount at most like square root of n when we make a query, then that would show that we need like square root of n queries in order to solve the problem. So I think maybe I won't show that now because, you know, there are some details to go through and it won't be that long, but maybe it would be too much to try to squeeze it in right now. So next time, what we're going to do is we're going to see that this quantity can't increase very much if we make a query, and that'll give us the search lower bound.